Yes, hello. I'm Jason Louvre. This is the Ultra Culture podcast, and I'm returning to doing more shows after a short hiatus while Ultra Culture moved. I'm hanging out in the new offices and just back settling in, preparing to bring lots more awesome content through the blog and ebooks and podcasts and classes and video and all kinds of stuff. So it's going to be very exciting over the rest of the year. And I'm hoping to return to regular podcasting. So welcome back, those of us who have listened to shows before, and hello if you are here for the first time. So, so my guest this week is Zach Leary, a friend who I've met through spiritual circles in Los Angeles. He's also the host of the new It's All Happening podcast, which he had me on recently. He's an infrequent blogger and writer and a seasoned digital marketer and brand strategist. According to his bio online, Zach is also a practitioner of Bhakti Yoga, as taught through many of the Vedantic systems of northern India. Through the practice of Bhakti, he's found keys that unlock doorways that allow the soul to experience its true nature of being eternal, full of knowledge, and full of bliss. In addition to Bhakti Yoga, Zach has been influenced by many different methods and traditions of consciousness exploration and heart opening, ranging from transhumanism and Hatha Yoga to Buddhism and clinical psychology. But above all, he believes first and foremost in his guru Neem Karoli Baba's teaching that love is the strongest medicine. So Zach's a very cool guy and a fellow traveler, and we had a lot to talk about, a lot in common. Not just our exploration of lots of different modes of consciousness exploration, but definitely our interest in Eastern systems. Zach has studied, obviously, a lot of Bhakti and Kirtan, and as a Kirtan performer. And I have studied a lot of, Kriya Yoga, Tantra, Vedanta, and the various, you know, Raja Yoga, Jnana Yoga, the various different types of yoga. I've had an extreme interest in Indian philosophy and practice for since I was a teenager. For the same amount of time, I've had an interest in magic, going back to when I worked in an Indian bookstore, an importer in San Diego when I was 16, and was exposed to the incredibly psychedelic and elaborate and precise and academically vast world of Indian spirituality, and continuing on with, you know, my own adventures going to India and studying with Indian gurus and things like that. So all that is a lot of that Zach and I have in common, but maybe we have it so much in common that we ended up not talking about it a whole lot on this podcast. And I think we just automatically recognize that we're on the same page there, more or less. And so we delved into politics and the future and technology and Trump and kind of the conservative backlash going on in America, which is obviously scary to kind of lefty hippie guys such as myself and Zach. We kind of went all over the place. It's a really good show. Zach is definitely getting a following with his new show, so definitely check that out as well. It's called It's All Happening. It's on iTunes, and he's been interviewing all kinds of extremely successful and futuristic and exciting people. So definitely give that a listen. And please subscribe to us on iTunes. And definitely go to ultraculture.org, our website. Check out the blog articles, check out our books, our previous podcasts, and definitely check out, there's an 8-day course in chaos magic there, which is free, in which I cover the whole gamut of consciousness raising techniques. It's great for beginners and advanced practitioners alike. I use the term chaos magic because it's really a blanket term that covers all kinds of different spiritual traditions while distilling the essence of all of them. So it's a really good course. I'm really proud of it, and it's free for you to download at ultraculture.org. Okay, so lots of love to you, and without further ado, here's Zach. Okay, so I'm sitting here with Zach Leary from the It's All Happening podcast, who has very graciously come to the Ultra Culture office to tape a show. And we've been catching up a little bit about spirituality and politics and all of the big questions. And I wanted to kick off by asking you, Zach, about bhakti yoga, because this is a spiritual path, you're very devotional, musical, spiritual path that you're very involved in. And it's something that I'm fascinated by and something that there is, you know, a lot of interest in, obviously, in Southern California and other places. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I think some listeners of the show may be familiar with, or they may have kind of a passing intellectual understanding of it from reading like Vivekananda or other writers about it. But it's so radically different from so many of the cut and dried academic or, you know, spiritual paths. So I'm curious how you got into it and what it is and how it works.
Well, first, thanks for having me, Jason. It's good to be here into the Ultra Culture office. So, bhakti yoga, I think the best way to really explain bhakti yoga is through the lens of the Vaishnav lens. In India, generally, I mean, just to...
Do you want to define Vaishnav?
Yeah, for sure. In India, I mean, generally speaking... there are Vaishnavs, there are Shivites, and there are Shaktas. And the Vaishnav school is basically lineages that come from the worship of Vishnu and all of Vishnu's offshoots. And in modern India, within the last 1,000 years, that's Krishna and Ram primarily make up the Vaishnav schools of thoughts in those traditions. And Shivites worship Shiva, and Shaktas worship the mother. And then there are, of course, gurus and lineages that mix them all together and don't really see one as more powerful than the other. But when I think talking about defining bhakti yoga, the Vaishnav way of thinking about it and the way of defining it is really appropriate and very effective in the sense that it defines bhakti yoga as it's the yoga of love and devotion. But if you just kind of look at that on its own, well, what is the yoga of love and devotion? What does that mean? What do you do? You know, it doesn't really imply anything other than you just stay in love and stay devoted. But where is the action in that? And the action is within your mood. It's within cultivating your mood. So on a very extreme level, if you look at the Hare Krishna movement, you know, their entire practice is about staying in service to Krishna. It's about staying in love with Krishna in the mood of Radha. So Radha, Krishna's consort, the female aspect of God, was constantly just in love with Krishna, was just in love with God, and every waking moment was there to serve and to experience the pleasure, the transcendental nature of God, and in that case, in Krishna. And Radha was just there, was just wanted to stay in that space of intoxication. And that is bhakti yoga, it's just staying in that mood of experiencing the transcendental the transcendental realm, which is love, which is divinity, which is the perfection of Godhead, which is union with spirit. And that's what bhakti yoga is. It's really about the cultivations of the mood. So it's not like the practices themselves, you know, share a lot of practices with other forms of yoga, like hatha yoga, the movement, chanting, kirtan, jhana yoga, is, of course, reading the Vedas and scriptures and, you know, things like that, pranayama, and all of those things. But all roads lead back to bhakti. So you are chanting or you're doing hatha yoga or reading scriptures or Vedas or whatever, or having, you know, a spiritual discussion just to cultivate that mood that leads you back to that place of being intoxicated with the divine.
Okay, so it's kind of like using any tool you can in order to get into that attitude.
Yes. And I think there's one of the primary differences with bhakti yoga as opposed to maybe some of the other forms is that it's not so much about liberation. It's not so much about moksha.
Okay, that's interesting. That's something I hadn't heard before.
Yeah, in the sense that moksha or liberation, can sometimes be defined as becoming like, you know, free from birth and then just complete separation. Or, you know,
free from moksha would be free from having to incarnate again.
Free from having to incarnate again, right?
Okay.
And then, you know, and then just there is no separation at all. And merging back into the one, which is a beautiful sentiment and one I also subscribe to in a sense. But some forms of bhakti, the emphasis can be put on staying in that transcendental intoxication. That's the place to be. That's ultimate place to be, is in love.
So staying in the world, yeah. And staying high, basically.
Yes. Okay. Right. Got exactly.
It. So that's very interesting to me. That to me seems to have a lot of overlap with the tantric ideas.
Yeah.
And the tantric schools, and you know, certainly, you know, my during my tantric training into the tantric lineages in India, there was a lot of emphasis on the idea of, you know, which is this idea which is radically disturbing to many people on Western spiritual paths, which is that there's nothing wrong with the world.
Right.
Right. That right. Everything is actually fine. This is this I find is one of the most terrifying ideas for people. Because if you look at the legacy of, you know, Christianity obviously posits this separation from God, that there's something wrong with us. We've been thrown out of the Garden of Eden.
Major duality. Yes.
Buddhism is very similar. Yeah. That the world is an illusion and is a trap and is not a good place to be.
Right.
You know, all the monotheisms kind of, and plus Buddhism, have this idea. So just to say, you know, look, everything is fine. Nothing needs to be changed. Nothing needs to be fixed. Everything is essentially okay.
Yeah.
You know, there might be ups and downs in the Leela, as it were, but everything's fine. People hate this idea. It totally robs them of their bad mood, their right. messianic complex, their feeling that they somehow have to save the world, you know, which, and that for me is the core of something that, and this is very hard for me to grasp when I approach the Indian traditions, that like everything is actually okay.
Yeah.
And that just undercuts the Western ego completely.
Well, it does. And two things that arise from that for me are, one, I mean, just take a very basic, almost cliched perspective on that, right? Everything is happening exactly as it should.
It's all happening.
Right. Right. Yes. But I mean, everything, you know, stars are collapsing on each other, then being reborn, the universe is spinning, the planets are revolving, everything is happening exactly as it should and as it always has. And, you know, we are merely, you know, however you want to look at what the human incarnation is or is not, I think we could all agree it's pretty much just a blip on some radar that can't quite be explained. We don't quite have that bit figured out yet. So it's just, all of this is kind of happening. And if you look at a human society as throughout recorded history, since the dawn of recorded history, it's arguable. One can make the case that there isn't any more strife now than there ever has been.
There's actually an incredible amount less.
Right.
I was actually, before you came over, I was arguing about this on Facebook, as I do. Yeah, there was an amazing data visualization that somebody put together called, I believe it's called The Fallen of World War II, where they visualized deaths in world conflicts up until World War II, and you just get to World War II, and it's just this incredible mountain of death, where just the casualties on particularly the Russian side and the German side, and then obviously the English and American side and the Japanese side with the bomb dropping. It's just it's a staggering.
Right.
It's completely unfathomable. And then you get to, as soon as World War I also just incredible
numbers. The numbers.
Incredible. Yeah. And then as soon as this kind of nuclear detente happens after, or kind of nuclear brinksmanship happens after World War II, and this kind of new balance of power happens, it's almost inconsequential, the number of deaths that are occurring. So we really have lived since World War II in kind of the longest peace in right. human history, despite some of the negative things that are happening. But our media is so much more advanced that we're constantly being bombarded.
Well, the world's smaller. The planet is smaller now.
Yes.
And the sensation of that is magnified times, you know, exponentially greater.
Right.
I mean, it used to be, you know, 100 years ago, if we were sitting in this building 100 years ago talking about what was going on in the Middle East, not only would we not be talking about that, but if we were to talk about that, it's generally accepted that we wouldn't really care. That was, that might as well have been Mars. It was so far away and such a distant foreign land that took 2 months to get to that it just didn't apply. You were just like, well, it doesn't, you know. So
unless there were, you know, if the country was involved in that area, you know, like with the British Empire being in the Middle East, for instance.
Yes. Of course. But yeah, and that did start, but those ideas, you know, so and now, you know, the what's going on in Syria or Iraq, it's just, it feels much closer to us because it is. It doesn't take that long to get there now, and the geopolitical ramifications. So, and you know that book, there's that great book, The Better Angels of Our Nature.
I was just, this came up during the Facebook argument. Yes.
Yeah. And there's great stats in that that makes that supports what you're talking about. It's really interesting.
So this is hilarious because we during my my argument there was that book came up and I think and I may my understanding is he breaks the, here we go, see, it's all happening, it's everything is unfolding as it should. So Steven Pinker in that book I think breaks down he lays out six factors for why the world is getting better, and most of them, to my knowledge, I haven't read the book, but most of them are essentially that we're just kind of getting nicer and there's been this progression in human rights. And,
right.
But my view is that it's the bomb, right? The reason the world is in a peaceful situation is because no one wants to start a worldwide conflict like World War II again because of the nuclear weapons are on the table.
Well, that's on a macro level. On a micro level, it's also, and Pinker gets into it, it's also because we have, and it's... It almost seems impossible to believe because you look around the world and look at Donald Trump and you don't believe this to be true. But with that said, that we have adopted a form of interpersonal understanding and compassion towards one another that we have not really experienced before. So like, for instance, in the year, I think it's like in the year 1500 or 1450 or something like that, you know, the leading cause of death for a man age 30 was not infection from disease, it was violence. It's because the land was being raped and pillaged. And if you spoke against the king, your head would be chopped off. Or if you practiced a weird form of religion, your head would be chopped off. You know, and that's the way it was.
It still is.
It still is in the Middle East. But, you know, so we're doing a little bit better.
Right.
You know.
I think there's a really strong case to be made for, you know, obviously Western culture has progressed so far since certainly since the Enlightenment, and but that's only part of the world, you know.
It is only part of the world, and actually I was talking about this on my own podcast yesterday, is that you know, the Enlightenment got us to one stage, which it kind of took us all the way to the industrial revolution, and now we're still stuck in this industrial revolutionized way of looking at the human condition, especially in the West, that, you know, human beings are sort of, you know, we're brought up and we're put into this education system that produces workers that are, you know, create sort of a worker base that goes out and farms and creates economy, and then that global economy, that economy of community, is measured as a GDP. And we're still talking about the world that way in 2016. That's how we measure progress, as well. Growth, economic growth. And everybody, every politician in the world in America shares that, you know, economic growth and, you know, the GDP and just rising. And that's how we measure our condition and progress. And that's kind of it's a very antiquated way of thinking.
Well, it's an important metric. It's what we
it is an important
one metric, you know.
It is one metric, but it's not the only one.
Right.
So, I mean, now the, you know, the new economies of creativity and the new ways of perceiving value.
Right.
Are
oh, it's amazing. I mean, just the last few years, going from how fast, especially with creative people, I think how fast the economy is changing from this idea that you go to a 9-to-5 job. I mean, even in the 70s, Buckminster Fuller was saying it's completely wasteful to have somebody go sit in an office between 9-to-5. It's just like that there's no reason for this. It doesn't really accomplish anything. Now people are working, anywhere in the world. They're working on, essentially intangible virtual products.
Right.
And at the same time, they now no longer have any separation between work and the rest of their life because they're on all the time. Right. And the gig economy with Uber and Airbnb and things like that, and how fast technology is just completely, I think, opening up the world to total individual and creative expression and abilities for liberation.
Yeah.
From the, the grid system of the economic grid system where you were just locked into a role for your entire life.
I tend to agree, and I tend to hope for that as well and strive for that. I think that's a tremendous measure of progress if we do kind of get into those areas, for sure, and what we're seeing, there's also the problems of that grid system getting locked into a role for life, is that the great promise of what those things, why they were created and how they were laid out are becoming untrue.
Oh, in terms of having any type of security or retirement.
Exactly.
Or, yeah.
The American dream. Right. I mean, it was like at one point, yes, it was true. You went to an office and you got paid $2 an hour and you could buy a car and 2.5 children.
Could buy a house.
You could buy a house.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not happening these days. you have all these people, breaking their backs and for whatever reason and getting lost into these roles that are completely valueless, not just morally, but also economically.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think that definitely if you want to measure progress in, if you want to measure progress in terms of maybe human creative expression or freedom, it's just been incredible. I don't know how you want to measure economic progress with the gig economy. I think that in general, things are kind of better now in the Western world than they have been for a long, long time.
Yeah.
Or ever. Right?
Yeah.
And yet at the same time, I look out and I look on the internet, particularly with younger people, and it's just like people are like disintegrating in acid, basically, not the good kind, but like, it's just like people have no idea how to cope. Their identities are disintegrating. Some of like the fighting that's happening online and, the particularly around the current election and what people think is important. And, I look at particularly young people coming out of school with, saddled with student debt and just faced with this chaos of,
I tend to agree that if you do look at the West, things are incredibly promising and there's a lot of great things to look at too. But if you also, there's still a huge faction, especially within America, that is beholden to an old way of thinking that is really trapped in a culture of fear and in a culture of not knowing what to do. The steel worker or the coal worker or something like that, generations of coal workers. And I get this intellectually, we can't get rid of coal because that's West Virginia, that goes back, generations. And that's what we do. What else are we going to do? So they're left in kind of this smoke of reinvention, of not knowing what else people are what they're going to do with their lives.
Right.
And that's a tricky predicament. And you're obviously a very evolved, thoughtful human being and can expand on these notions and kind of create realities for yourself, like creating ultra culture and being here in this office and doing a podcast and kind of creating your own reality. Mm-hmm. But for a lot of people, it's not that easy.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. It's not.
And yeah, I would be, if I lived anywhere in the U.S. outside of the coasts, basically,
yeah,
I would be so angry at people like me. Right. I would, anyone who has anything to do with Silicon Valley, with any type of tech thing, anyone who has an app or a website, or drives an Uber or whatever, I would be so angry to be, if you look at these towns and the fact that their industries have been gutted and everyone's on, OxyContin.
Right.
And it's just, I would feel so
alienated. Did you see that movie? You see that movie, OxyContin?
No.
Yeah, I haven't seen the whole thing, but there's a very long extended 10-minute preview version of it online, which is about an old Kentucky, right? Kentucky or Tennessee. It's either Kentucky or Tennessee. Not that they're the same, but I think it's Kentucky, about an old mining town that just went under, and the entire town is on OxyContin.
Right.
And just the doldrums of what's happened to that. I mean, literally the whole town is strung out. Wow. And it's become just this weird dystopian third world sort of like steel, tin, corrugated, strung out needle backwoods sort of.
Wow. That's a lot of places.
Yeah. That's a lot of places.
My understanding is the way that happens is that the all of the senior citizens get prescribed OxyContin for their various ailments, and then they turn around because they don't have any, you know, they're you know, drawing on pensions or not drawing on pensions, or they don't have work and they have no money. They turn around and sell it to the young people for some huge markup, and then everyone's on OxyContin.
Right.
And which is basically heroin. It is heroin.
It is, so, yes. It's strong heroin too. Yes.
So, and then, you know, obviously meth, and it's just, what a nightmare.
Yeah, yeah. It's a disaster.
That's a terrible to look at that and say, this is what has happened to the heartland of America, and this is what happened to, really, that is America, you know, not the coasts in a lot of ways. You know, that's so, and it's a shame.
And that is why, and that is how, you know, somebody like Donald Trump gets a voice. You know, it's the big issue I think that we have to look at with something like that is the systemic cause. It's not like that the person himself. I mean, yeah, we can kick and scream all day about how terrible he is, how terrible this whole thing is, but more terrible is what's the systemic.
Right.
What it is? How did our soil get so fertile to be able to support something like this? You know, how did that happen?
Yeah, let's talk about that, because that's there's a lot there. I think that because I was thinking about this morning, and I was thinking about this, in the same way you just put it, which is what's the systemic? You know, why is somebody like Donald Trump manifested, essentially? Right. Why is someone like Milo Yiannopoulos manifested?
Yeah.
You know, where did he come from? Right. Right. You know, why does he tap into so much, you know, what's he tapping into? What's there? Mm. And I think that I have to put myself in the place of, again, of a young person coming into, if I was a young person getting out of school with $50,000 of student debt, no job prospects, mm-hmm. no, you know, looking at a lifetime of indentured servitude, basically.
Yeah.
And all I'd been taught in, and then realizing that essentially what I'd been sold for that $50,000 was kind of the liberal university experience of learning how to privilege check and problematize things and trigger warnings and safe spaces and things like that. And then essentially feeling just jilted and not being given anything as a consumer, essentially, by the educational system, I kind of understand why there would be so much anger, and why I think that over the last 8 years, there's been so much divisiveness and divide and conquer politics on the left, and internal fighting, and no consensus making.
Yeah.
That I understand why people are angry, and I'm afraid, and I think that it's kind of inevitable, I'm afraid that we really are on the verge of a gigantic shift to the right. It's already happened in Europe with things like,
what we're seeing in France, yeah.
Right, and the Golden Dawn in Greece and things like that, and now it's happening here, and this is what it looks like. And, you know, obviously there's so much anger in Europe at the immigration issue. There's so much anger. There was already so much anger with the collapse of the Eurozone.
Right.
And, you know, I think that, you know, there is a shift to the right happening, and a lot of it is, unfortunately, I think there have been serious issues on the left.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and I hate to say it, and this is, I was kind of been brewing on this for a little while, but, and I think you and I are more or less of the same vintage, but, you know, I remember like when the internet was first, you know, when it was first kind of taking steam and first starting to run and on both legs and really starting to take the world over, there was this incredible like shroud of hope and promise within it.
Yeah.
That it was going
to, yes.
you know, not only connect us all together, but it was also going to like distribute information in this way that was going to kind of make the truth be seen and heard.
Right.
You know, and
if you think about things like, you know, Doug Rushkoff's early books or The Well or
sure.
Yeah, oh, I mean, I was so excited.
Mondo 2000. And
exactly. That was reading that stuff, you know, that was the world that I expected to grow up and inherit.
That's right.
And instead, I grew up into the post 9/11 feudalistic hell world.
Yeah. And you know, granted, there's still some of those things that are left. I mean, I don't want to totally get into a Bernie Sanders thing, but to me, Bernie Sanders is a good. That's a progress meter, even though he's probably not going to win. Mm. Hey, at least that's, you know, at least he's bringing up a discussion.
Right. These serious issues are being addressed.
At least he's saying some things that you never thought we were going to hear on national television for a long time. You know, he's bringing up these big issues, and that is pretty cool. But so much of this is like what we were talking about before. And if you live in the flyover states and why you have a right to be pissed. And I think so much of that has to do with media and how it's distilled information into like the short attention span theater thing, that even though the dissemination of information and whatever it is you want to call truth, and I know what alter culture and generally magic speaks of is really, you know, finding, you know, the sincere and the ultimate truths. They're out there.
Or at least the ones your own truth.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But I think a lot of people don't want to, you know, they're almost like they don't want to know. And like these sound bites of like, you know, of TMZ, Kardashian, and now Trump culture. Trump is a reflection of that. To me, he is just the politician. He is just the representative of the Kardashian, TMZ, Paris Hilton. Like I was almost like thinking of like, you know, the Trump revolution started when A Simple Life got renewed for a second season on Fox. You know, when you all of a sudden got to be famous for nothing because the new media environment created, you know, that soil that allowed that to be fertile.
Well, I also think that in many ways, Trump is also the, you know, the reaction, or some of his younger supporters, I think, are reacting. And Milo Yiannopoulos is a perfect example of this.
Yes.
Are reacting against what they perceive as essentially media corruption on the left.
Okay.
And I'm thinking of things like Gawker, you know, obviously. Yep. And the fact that for the last 8 years, the culture of attack blogging, and that essentially we've had a small group of powerful left-wing websites with armies of 23-year-old bloggers making $23,000 a year. I used to be one of them.
Okay.
And who are just pumping out, like you said, sound bites of just attack, you know, and they've gone to school and haven't really learned to do anything except look at literature and find it problematic.
Right.
So they take that into journalism and this idea of, you know, constant attack blogging and identity politics policing and call it you're sexist, you're racist, that spiraled so far out of control and became, you know, and I saw it with Occupy as well, the constant divide and conquer and the way that left constantly attacks itself and is unable to reach a consensus. Mm. And I think that was kind of essentially the power, the media power structure during the Obama years. And
he certainly did not help that.
No, I think that Obama's, Obama's been a great president in many ways. In other ways, he's been horrific. I think that his inability to find consensus, to build consensus or build bridges between the left and the right.
Yeah. You know, that's been his greatest failure.
Right.
Yeah.
And people say, well, he had a Republican Congress. Well, he's the most powerful man in the world.
Right.
He's a great communicator. He should be able to build bridges.
Yeah.
And instead of, you know, not being able to. And I think that has echoed into the media in the form of, you know, blogging about how stupid Republicans are, blogging about how stupid Christians are.
Right.
You know, this kind of tyranny of the left once the left came into power. And I think that part of the backlash, unfortunately, against that we saw, for instance, with the Hulk Hogan win against Gawker, or that creates bizarre monstrosities like Milo Yiannopoulos,
Yeah.
You know, I think that this is kind of the inevitable reaction of essentially what happened when Obama came into power. The left came into power. The left came into essentially unchallenged media power and essentially just toadied up to Obama, did not challenge him on any of the real issues, like, for instance, the NDAA, the blanket surveillance, not in any real way. Obviously, there are exceptions. Any of the guttings of civil liberties that he did, the drone strikes, you know, right. Obviously there are exceptions like Democracy Now or Vice or many places, but there's just been this kind of toadying up to power. And I think that people have caught on to that now.
Yeah. I think you're right. And in addition to, guys like Miles Yiannopoulos, it's also, again, fitting into that culture of, the media landscape. It gives you this ability, if you know how to use it and manipulate it correctly, it gives you this ability to kind of create this monstrosity for yourself that is basically like performance art, soundbite kind of stuff.
Which he's very good at.
Which that's what he is. Yeah. I mean, like, he ultimately doesn't make any sense.
I doubt that he even really believes in most of what he's saying.
Yeah, you know, like, exactly.
He's just churning for attention.
And it's working. For his own personal brand, it's churning and it's working and he's getting his impressions and he's created this thing for himself. But he's like, you know, claims to be, well, he is gay and blogs about and posts tweets about big black dicks all the time. But then, you know, is anti-gay rights at the same time. So it's just like this huge, gigantic contradiction in trying to make any progress, and it's just kind of giving him the loudest megaphone, which is problematic. And it's just, and listening to you talk about it too, I think one of the more, I was watching Obama on the South by Southwest thing. Did you watch that?
I didn't watch it, but I read the transcript.
Yeah, and it was, it's good. I'm glad he did it. And, it's good that he has some sort of sensitivity and perception of these problems. But if one thing Obama's not, he's not as literate technically as you kind of want him to be. I think he has a lot of, he has a lot of great qualities about, you know, sensitivities towards race and towards compassion and different economies of scale and things like that. But there's a lot of technical stuff and like subtleties within media environments.
What's an example?
Well, he just didn't like quite get like the moderator, who's I forget his name, but the guy who was interviewing him, the moderator, he was kind of like calling him out on you know, governmental systems are basically these huge, gigantic, onerous, antiquarian, you know, ancient sort of systems that are based on bureaucracies, and they're probably still running like IBM PCs on a 486,
it's like the DMV,
and on
a bad day,
and they're just like on these ancient systems, and they can't move and they can't change. And whereas like something like a giant structure like Google or Facebook, they're built to be nimble and they change really, really quick, and their cultures are about staying adept. You know, and like Obama almost didn't quite get that. It was like he didn't quite cop to that.
Well, that's interesting you bring that up, because I think that really cuts to the core of kind of what we're seeing right now, which is the jockeying for power between the government and, yes, corporations. That battle's already been won with the TPP, thanks to Obama.
Right. But disaster.
With the tech industry.
Yeah.
And I think that it was instructive to watch the FBI versus Apple debate, because the subtext there was, okay, who gets to say, right? You know, Apple is basically saying, well, the tech industry is big enough to challenge the government over issues like privacy from what's presumably considered a altruistic perspective, because the tech industry has a messianic complex and thinks that everything they're doing is correct and the most advanced.
Right.
But in a way, that was fascinating to watch, because in a way, you know, I understood, you know, the Apple was saying, you know, that there should be privacy. The government is saying, no, there should be not in cases of terrorism. Apple saying there's a slippery slope. But the subtext being, well, who gets the say? Who's in control? And in a way, I'm kind of glad it was the FBI, because as, you know, draconian as the FBI can be and how many abuses of power there are and things like that.
Yeah.
Do you really want guys like Mark Zuckerberg at the top of the totem pole? Do you really want them to be able to operate unchecked without any government oversight?
Yeah, I mean, if you put it that way, I do tend to agree with you. But if I do put it the other way, that, like, you know, Tim Cook was sort of standing up for you and me, and that, like, well, there's got to be somewhere to draw the line.
Was he really, though, or was it the subtext of battle for power with the government?
Well, I think it was a little bit of both, but I do think there was a general sort of, like, kind of well-intentioned, you know, kind of old-school Silicon Valley kind of where information is, it's like EFF kind of stuff.
Right.
I do think that I bought that. I mean, I did pick a little bit of that up. It's that, well, where do we stop? You know, if I unlock this iPhone, and it's just, it's a piece of code that gets out there into the world, and where are we going to stop? And I did pick up a little bit of sincerity from him in that, and that they were going back to the roots a little bit. But then what? It only ended, right? Because the FBI figured it out on their own.
Right.
They didn't need their Apple's help.
Somebody potentially jumped. Somebody helped them.
Right.
But so that's one case. And then we've got things like, for instance, Hillary is raising so much, is so concerned about the gig economy. And so we've got things like the government, is considering antitrust against Uber and things like that. So that, for me, just that, without citing one way or the other, mm-hmm. and just observing that objectively, that's really interesting, because we are in a position now where it seems like tech is one of America's last remaining profitable industries.
Yeah.
And Obama, I think a year or two ago, wrote a piece on Medium for millennials about the challenges in the workplace, because that's where you go to talk to the millennials. And it was a really fascinating article, because he basically, if you read between the lines, what he basically says in that article is, kids go work in the tech industry because there's nothing else left.
Right.
And if you really want to, if you still want to live the American dream, like, go toady up to the tech industry. That's a really dangerous position, because now we have the tech elite,
right,
in an almost unprecedented position of power. And I know that there are, I know through the pipeline, and I think it's, you know, people are well aware that there are a lot of right-wing ideas circulating within the tech industry. Not everyone is so altruistic as Tim Cook. Not everyone has the old EFF Silicon Valley ideas.
Yeah.
There are a lot of that kind of, like, extreme tech libertarianism, the idea of seceding from the country, the idea that they should not have to pay taxes to the rest of the country, the idea of even these kind of bizarre, what's that called, neo-reactionary ideas about kind of bringing almost this tech feudalism back, bringing this kind of feudalistic elite back.
But I don't know if that's a new thing. I think that is just an extension of media. I mean, it kind of goes back to another movie, Network, from the 70s, mm-hmm. you know, when you're meddling with the primal forces of nature. You know, there are no more countries. There's only AT&T, IBM, and all the countries are the companies that he names. And that movie's 1976 or something like that. So I don't think that idea is new. It's a classic McLuhan, you know, phenomenon. It's like, it just happens that tech companies are controlling the message.
Right.
Well, more so.
It's not new, but there's an incredible centralization of money and power.
Yes, there is, because there's really just a big three.
Right.
Yes, and that is problematic.
Well, in the media, you mean?
Or in tech. I mean, there's
Google, Apple, and Facebook.
And Facebook, yeah. Okay. I mean, there's big three who dominate the valley.
Right.
You know, of course, there are others who are participating, but there's a big three, and that is a tremendous... I find that to be a tremendous problem. I don't think it's anybody's fault. I don't think it's a lack of regulation or deregulation or anything like that. I just think that it's a complicated issue, but problematic.
And they do control essentially our realities now.
Yes, they do.
And also this is now more a problem now because of the TPP and because of these laws being written that allow companies to sue governments. So I really think that we're in the long predicted but now happening transition to this kind of corporate world. And because of that, um, I don't know how much longer governments are going to be as relevant.
As relevant. That's the whole idea. That's the whole notion, right? And every time I see something like this go on with the FBI versus Apple or Hillary talking, you know, bringing up these things about shared economies and things, you know, about the Justice Department going after Uber, I think that's just government kicking and screaming, trying to remain relevant in the only way that they know how.
I agree. And I think that's why I was kind of glad to see Apple lose on that round, despite all of the extreme ramifications of that. But because, I think it's like at the end of the day, who do you want running your life? Kind of a bored, incompetent government bureaucrat or Martin Shkreli?
You know? Don't want Martin Shkreli. That doucher. Yeah.
Right.
Definitely don't want him. Right.
But he so typifies the kind of the mindset, you know, of these young guys in Silicon Valley in some ways.
In some ways,
in an extreme, exaggerated way.
He is for sure. And then if you look at a reality like San Francisco, for instance, let's look at the city as a whole. And, you know, as much as, you know, somewhat. Accomplished upscale white person like myself, like San Francisco, and it's a beautiful place. It's really become sort of like this dystopian, sanitized city that has become a byproduct of these big tech companies. It's like, look what happened, you know?
Oh, it's
we
crazy.
Get to take over one of America's great cities and make it into, you know.
And only the most elite of the tech.
Only the most elite of the tech can live here.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Last time I was there, every time I go there, it's totally different. And I went there last summer, and it was crazy for me to drive into the city, which I went to school in the Bay Area. I'm very familiar. But and now driving into it, it looks like some type of William Gibson creation. And at the same, I looked every single billboard, you know, by way of demonstration for those who have not been there. Every single billboard in San Francisco is for an app. But not just for an app that you might download, but for an app that one startup is selling to another. So their business to business
products. B2B stuff, yeah. Right. And enterprise level stuff, too. I mean, every time I get off in the airport there, I always look at the billboards in the San Francisco airport. And some of the billboards, unless you're well schooled, you won't know what they mean. They're like for enterprise, you know, solutions like Cisco kind of stuff or banking software or like a new Oracle patch that. You have no idea what the hell it means.
Right.
It's Blade Runner.
Right.
Yeah.
And then I come back to LA and it's like going 75 years backwards in time in a way, you know?
Yeah, we are going. But in a way I like that because LA still feels a little bit more egalitarian to me. Feels a little bit fairer.
Yeah. LA is in many ways the kind of progressive utopia.
I think so.
Right. And it's a place where young people can still thrive to some extent, you know, unlike New York where you go and you just get eaten. But or San Francisco, where you go and you just can't live there unless you're working at a big corporate like Google or something like that.
Right, or live in Oakland or something. Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
And even Oakland is getting crazy expensive.
Is it?
So yeah. LA really is, and it's hard to living here. It's easy to forget the realities of most of the rest of the country and of the world, certainly, and how. Our progressive ideals are not shared by most of the people in America.
That is a true statement, and all of these things, all these topics that we're talking about, you know, in a lot of ways, I've almost, as I get older, I almost have like this softer place in my heart that there needs to be some sort of like I'm more interested in government now than I ever have been.
Okay.
Yeah. In the sense that there is still a role for government. If government can get smarter and nimble, maybe a little bit smaller and find ways to sort of participate in the shared economy or the new progressive ways of information dissemination or any of these things like Obama was trying to do at South by Southwest, it still plays a role because how else are the displaced coal workers from West Virginia going to find a new way to live, you know, some sort of government sort of pointing them in the right direction and kind of creating a safety net or whether it's, new training programs or making the mandates for new alternative energy packages to go in those places where those workers can be retrained and, you know, so
that would obviously create a lot of jobs.
The free market alone is not going to No, it's not going to fix it.
No, it's going to produce Martin Shkreli over and over again, you know, and San Francisco, and not a whole lot else.
Yes.
I think it seems to me the way it's going.
It absolutely. Yep.
Okay, so we've been through the chaos of the world.
Yeah.
Let's take it back to everything's fine.
Yeah, and there is one thing I wanted to say about that. It's because we did start off talking about bhakti yoga and everything's fine and everything. And issue that comes up with that perspective and also from the Steven Pinker book as well is that if you just look at the world solely through that lens, to me, it gives a lot of people a cop-out. Like, I notice that with people who really support the Steven Pinker book all the time.
The spiritual bypassing.
The spiritual bypassing. So look, did you read that book, The Better Angels of Our Nature? Look, we're less violent now than we ever have been. Okay, well, that's fine, but that doesn't, like, that doesn't mean everything. We have to stop being progressive and stop fighting for, you know, what's right and the gun madness and gun, you know, whatever it is, that there's still a lot of huge problems that have to do with violence and intolerance and lack of compassion. And even though, yes, the universe is working exactly as it should be, it doesn't mean that we should spiritually bypass and stop taking action.
Right. So, okay, so then the question is, so I think you and I are in an interesting position of looking at this extremely futuristic chaos of the world as it is right now, but kind of employing, you know, ancient spiritual technology to
right,
which is like, I always wake up and feel like I'm living in a William Gibson book now. It's like, it's very bizarre.
It's a weird juxtaposition.
Yeah, but kind of like certainly the Hindu traditions and, you know, the tantric stuff is 14th century technology and seeing the world as essentially fine and as a series of divine leelas. And we both know people who yes, use that as a way to not take action ever. And we know people who are just are just totally checked out in kind of the New Age circus.
Yes.
And not seeing the world or its issues at all, or kind of engaged in extreme kind of New Age capitalism and not considering the non-enlightenment, the fundamental non-enlightenment of some of the things they're doing, like the Amanda Chantal Bacon. Effect,
yes.
Right?
Oh, yes. Her. Yes.
Right.
Oh, I love that. That was one of my favorites.
Right. So how do you navigate, you know, what's a good way to navigate some of those issues?
It's a great topic and ripe for discussion for sure. It's just, you know, hiding on Topanga Canyon and drinking your green juice, you know, it's not enough, you know.
Right.
You can't pull down the shades, you know. I do think that I think you navigate these waters by encouraging some form of conscious activism. And, you know, one of my pet peeves for sure, which I always get in, with people on Facebook and stuff, is in the New Age community, people who are adamant about never watching the news.
Right.
That it disturbs their reality and there's too much negative energy coming off of it. I don't want to be a part of that. They don't speak for me. I really can't get on board with that. And I don't support that way of thinking, because we're all in this together.
Right.
And because the world has gotten smaller, you have to accept that fact that we're all in this together.
Right.
And you can't just check out anymore. And it doesn't matter if you're living off the grid and, you know, turning all your poop into compost and growing your own fruit. You know, that's great. I'm glad you are. But still, you know, we need to bring awareness to how all of our brothers and sisters are living.
Right.
Even if the reality might really suck, you know.
Well, I just look at it as if all is one, to take the classic spiritual dictum, you know, if all is one, that includes all the fucked up, broken,
absolutely
disturbed, horrible, you know, parts of the world, human trafficking, sex slavery, the crimes of this, that, and the other.
Absolutely.
You know, it's like all of that is also part of the Leela, if you will.
It's the great, you know, it's the great Buddha setup. It's why do you think the first noble truth has to do with suffering?
You know,
it's because it is all connected. You know, you need the suffering in order to make the happiness more happy, or the sadness to make, you know, the joy more joyful. You know, you need them both. You need the duality of it all to work together.
Right.
And it is all one.
I think that the first noble truth, my understanding of it at least, is that the suffering arises from thinking that reality is real, essentially, and grabbing it, and from desire, right. And from desiring it to grab it, essentially.
Yes, but just the sheer acknowledgement that there is suffering, though, that is such a core element of the human condition.
But that can be taken too far as well, where you can say everything is suffering,
right?
You know, which is what essentially what the Buddha says, like everything is in a condition of suffering, and that's not totally true either.
I absolutely agree.
That's true. Yeah. You know, I definitely have been to the places they're talking about, and I have seen those sides of reality, but I don't think that it's not a mathematically valid statement to say all is suffering.
I agree with that. Yeah.
But the idea of interconnection, and also, which is a very prevalent Buddhist idea, that we are all interconnected, and we do need to see our connections and not check out and draw the blinds. And also that media has allowed us to be, and the internet has made that literally true in many ways, the interconnection.
The interconnectivity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But obviously I understand that people find it overwhelming, particularly people who are spiritual people tend to be a lot more empathic or sensitive, and it's just too much for them. But I hit against that all the time, and it drives me nuts of just that kind of checking out.
Yeah, there's a difference between being like empathic and very ultra sensitive towards what's going on around you, and then being just consciously checking out. So those are two different things to me. But just the consciously checking out thing, I don't think we're not afforded that luxury anymore. You know, we just don't have it anymore. And I love what you said too about being in a William Gibson novel, kind of living in that, and we're living in it. We're living in the singularity. We're living in the neuromancer reality, but we're applying these ancient technologies to these realities. And the whole New Thought, ancient wisdom school of spirituality. It's a good one, because human beings have done a lot of great things over the years. You know, hasn't all been bad. We've done a lot of great things, and maybe we hit, you know, some of our spiritual perfection, at least in terms of understanding how the universe works. Maybe we hit that quite a long time ago, and we understood it. We got a little glimpse into the interconnectivity that had nothing to do with technology, just had to do with a true kind of jumping into your spiritual heart and your spiritual center and realizing the world around you is all connected.
Yeah, I don't think that stuff ever changes, really.
I don't think so either, yeah. And applying these ancient technologies to them, and these ancient maps for consciousness to these new realities, these new paradigms that we find ourselves in, is a great a great acknowledgement of our thinking and of our progress. So they can, you know, mutually exist.
Well, I think that they can not only mutually exist, but that it's the crucial piece that people that can really help. You know,
you think so?
Well, to be connected to practical spirituality,
right,
and a sense of rootedness that comes from that, of being rooted to something beyond just reacting to your environment, and rooted into, you know, spirit, for lack of a better word, instead of just constantly being churned through the guts of the American nightmare.
Yeah. So what do we do? What do we do with the people? Okay. We talked a little bit about the people who, somewhat well-intentioned new age people who make the choice just to disengage and tune out and pull the shades down, go to yoga class, drink their green juice, but don't want to participate in anything. There's that subset of people. But what do you do with the people, the Kim Kardashian people, who, you know, the entire existence and the entire American reality is just about striving to be a baller, you know?
Well, I think that's great.
That's a tough one, though.
Well, they're basically playing the game of America. That's what the game of America is set up to do in many ways. And, you know, not everyone can be a serious meditator or a mystic person. That would be absurd.
That would be absurd.
Yeah, right. It would really suck, actually, because everyone would just be sitting around all day. But, you know, we need the... I think that the thing to do is to realize that everyone has a role, you know?
The world also needs ditch diggers.
Right. Yes. And the world needs Kim Kardashians. The world needs Elon Musk. the world needs the world needs these people. And I think that it can, it's easy to fall into the trap of saying everyone should be enlightened or everyone should share my ideology.
I totally agree with you, and I do appreciate that sentiment, and you're absolutely right. But just that, gosh, you know, just kind of combating that level of just that level of ignorance, you know, which is really the Donald Trump phenomenon, and you'll see it's embodied in everything that he's talking about, because ultimately he's talking about nothing. You know, when you hear him give a speech, it's not a speech. You know,
right.
It's just...
He rambles.
He rambles, and he makes some sort of, like, self-referential, narcissistic, statement about his past or something, or talks about, you know, just, it's, you know, we got to make America great again. You know, we're losing. We're not winning. And he's not saying anything.
Well, he's very clever in that way, because he knows how to communicate with people, where he's just saying, he's giving people sound bites. He's repeating things. He's, you know, and I've seen him do it. He's very good at communicating. And he knows that most people don't listen to
the details.
They really don't. They just react to their initial impression of the person.
I guess that's what I'm saying. It's like, yes, I don't need everybody to subscribe to my level, my ideology. I don't want that homogenization, but that lack of attention of paying attention to the details.
Right. But that's everyone, you know, human, that's across the board. We pay attention to things that we're interested in, and everything else we kind of tune out.
Yeah, but if you look at something like, say, the American Revolution, if you go back and read the papers of the day or the discourse of the day, what was going on back then, it was a pretty detailed discussion about pretty granular issues.
Okay.
You know, really diving into the issues in a very kind of granular, robust, and very aspirational way.
Okay.
You know,
how many people do you think were involved in those discussions?
I mean, that's a good question. I mean, certainly the minority.
Right.
There's no question about it. But if you go back and look at, you know, whatever recorded history we do have of the day, of those times, I mean it was pretty heady stuff.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I assume if you get your newspaper and that's all you have, you know, or going to have to read for that week, you know, it's like you have the time to sit with it, and it's really important.
Yeah.
Unlike the media glut and saturation, then I can certainly, it's going to be hopefully more info dense.
Yeah. So.
So yeah, but Kim Kardashian. I don't know. Well, I don't
know what the answer is.
I've never actually watched her show, so I don't really. I don't pay attention to it.
I just have such a problem with the culture of being famous for nothing.
Okay. They,
that's a relatively new phenomenon. Keep in mind, you know, that didn't used to happen before. Even when you had, like, you know, a pinup girl in the '50s, at least she acted. At least she was in movies. You know.
But I see that as a good thing, because that's like, I always
think
about, yeah, of course, because I always think about that, like, Crowley's thing, every man and woman is a star, right?
Yeah.
And I think that what that really is saying is, you know, I think there's been a real shift in the idea of what a human being is. And if you go back to the Middle Ages, the human being was a subject of the church and the king. And the king was also a subject of God, essentially. Everyone essentially exists as a subject of a slave master, essentially. Whether that's the king or the god he represents is essentially this all-empowered feudal overlord. And everyone is just exists just to serve.
Serve the king, right.
And even before that, if you go back to pre-monotheist, if you go back to Sumeria, you know, the Sumerians, the original religion, or the oldest one we have recorded, I believe, is, you know, their conception of human beings is that they were created as slaves to the gods.
Right.
You know, it's almost like this bizarre, like, Prometheus type thing.
Right, right.
But then we kind of got this idea, we went through the Enlightenment, and we got this idea of individual rights and the individual rights of man. And I think it's really only with Shakespeare and around that time that we get this idea of the human being as being, having any type of an internal life or existence as an individual.
Right.
Obviously, that's just for elites at that time. But then that kind of slowly filters out. We get the revolutions until essentially we're now in a position where the individual human being is the center of the universe instead of the overlord, king, or god. And I think that's there couldn't be anything more positive than that. And of course, some of them are going to be tacky. You know, that's just how it is.
Yeah, that is for sure. But
you know, YouTube stars. This is the book of the law. Every man and woman is a star.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. And if you take a the pop culture Andy Warhol perspective as well, but. You know, when you look at somebody like Kim Kardashian, whose entire existence and her entire enterprise is based on what kind of it's not substantial. It's based on what kind of stunt she can pull in the media to gain attention. And the latest one was she posted a naked picture of herself, looking in the mirror, some kind of selfie thing. And mm-hmm. and you know. I'm not a parent, but the classic message, like if you're a parent to a young girl, what kind of message does that send?
Right.
You know, it's like you can only be famous. You can only be her if you tweet naked pictures.
Right.
That's the only way you can be like her, honey. And you know how she got started? Because she released a sex tape of herself.
Right.
You know, that's the only way you can be like her, honey. And that's a terrible message to send.
But at the same time, should we police people's individual expression?
No. Absolutely not. And I don't know. I'm not implying we police or censor or anything like that. I'm just
even overtly, but the sense of, especially for, I think, coming from the spiritual traditions, there's this real... so it's a very a Protestant idea in some ways of this kind of like responsibility of shepherding people and
all I'm implying is that we don't make them famous. That's all.
Well,
we don't make them famous.
That's what people seem to want though. Yeah. Justin Bieber.
That is true.
Yeah. I think one of the things I've realized, running a website is that, the way the media is, the reason the media is the way it is not, I don't think, because of top-down control. It's because of serving public demand.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
well, demand always dictates, the reality of any supply. Yeah, take any case study. Absolutely.
Right.
But back to the original idea, which you first asked, is that notion of everything is fine.
Right. So
I guess everything is fine.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's variety to life, if anything else. So, okay, so in all these things that we've described, is there still a role for spirituality? Is it more important than ever? Is God still alive?
Yes. And I will take a very kind of centric approach to it in the sense that I think the role for spirituality is... cultivating your own heart space.
Okay.
And leaving it at that. I'm not even on a general mass adoption level. I'm not more aspirational than that. It's not about finding God or having a dialogue with God or anything like that. If you get to that level, great. That's really awesome. But it's just about cultivating a heart space that allows you the ability to create more compassion within your life.
Okay.
For me, as well as creating a little bit of a, cognitive dissonance as well that allows you to ask, the tougher questions and to look at issues with a little bit of objectivity to them, but just about cultivating heart space and, all the basic wonderful woo-woo cliches. I subscribe to those more and more the older I get. It's just how can we, and I see some of the things that you post, are you still vegan?
Yeah, still vegan.
Great. Ultimately, that's a great thing.
I'll be Amanda Chantal Bacon any day now and eating whatever it is.
$1,000 worth of food.
$1,000 worth of food a day. Yeah. So practically speaking, what are some ways that people can do that?
That's one. Become a vegan. Yeah. I think it's a wonderful aspirational thing. I am not a vegan, but I'm on team vegan all the way. I think that's a wonderful thing to do. Be more charitable. Mm-hmm. is another one. Being more compassionate to our being of service, I think it's a good one. All of these things, and creating an atmosphere of tolerance. In these days, I'm finding that to be incredibly important because we're seeing sort of a rise of intolerance, specifically mm-hmm. targeting a very specific group of people that is admittedly very problematic. And there's a huge number of that specific group of people that is challenging for us. What do we do?
But yeah, that really is the stress test for Western culture in a way, because it's the place where all of the West's values and the place where the West has convinced itself that it's the good guys are just breaking down.
But we have to go out on the edge of the cliff and increase our level of tolerance to make it work. You know, there's going to have to be some sort of understanding, you know, meeting of the minds between radical Islam, or it's not even radical Islam, just Islam in general, and everyone else in order to make it work.
But that's not happening.
It's not happening. I know it's not. And I realize that.
You know, as I said, the place where everything starts to break down, and that's an incredibly tough one. And I can see that one from both ends of the...
I do, too.
That there's just a horrific attack every few weeks, it seems, in Europe.
Even so, and it's like, and I hate kind of going to these places, but if you even look at the numbers of people who call themselves Muslim, who believe in Sharia law, mm-hmm. you know, who aren't radical terrorists or anything like that, but who subscribe to Sharia law, it's troubling.
Right.
You know, that's a tough thing to reckon with. But at the same time, you know, I'm all inclusive and I'm all tolerant and I don't want to ban anybody from anywhere. It's, you know, we got to figure out how to live together. A lot of people on the planet right now. And we're going to have to figure out how to share our resources. So this cultivation of heart practice and of cultivating some kind of spiritual practice, to me, just increases your ability to do so. And by not engaging any form of spiritual practice, whether it's magic or tantra or a Vaishnav Hinduism or whatever the fuck your practice is, all it's going to do is create distance.
Right. But Islam is one of the most extreme forms of spirituality in a way.
Yes,
there's a lot of spiritual practice that goes on there.
Yeah.
You know, but it's also, there's also a story attached to it where, you know, violence is okay, essentially.
Well, that's really one of the big, and I forgot who was talking about this. I think I heard it on NPR, but really what we're seeing here in what's going on in the Middle East is not so much West versus Islam or Christianity versus Islam. What we're seeing is a fundamental civil war going on within Islam for the future of their theology. Because not the whole Middle East is not subscribed to this radical notion of what Islam is, supporting violence and Sharia law. That is not everyone. There's a whole other faction that is tolerant and moderate, and we're basically seeing a civil war ensue over the future of this theology. And you know, the tribal, that's what the tribal wars are based on.
Is that war we want to get caught in the middle of?
Fuck no. Right. I don't think so.
But that seems to be what's happening.
Yeah, it is. And that's my, I have major problems with that.
Yeah. And that's
I have major problems with that because we don't, Americans, especially, you know, through leaders of the government, are not sensitive enough to these ancient cultures, and they go into places where they should not be, and they displace the culture and make it unstable, and thus factions emerge from those, like ISIS.
Right.
Like ISIS only exists because we destabilized Iraq.
Right.
It's not like we created ISIS, but we created ISIS by destabilizing Iraq.
Right. Exactly.
You know,
we laid the
footwork for it to be created.
We laid the footwork for it to be created. But the other end of that is every time one of these terror attacks happens, I see places. The first thing that happens every time is I see outlets like Salon and things like that saying, "This is our fault. How did we do this?" And that to me is a fundamental failure of the media to look at things clearly. And that's the place where everything breaks down, essentially, is navigating these issues.
Yeah, that's a difficult one.
It's very, I don't know. It's such a bizarre position to be in as a culture. And so because of that, you know, and because I have to do the Robert Anton Wilson thing always and understand everybody's opinions at all times and hold them all simultaneously and try to, you know, especially which is a good practice now, especially in the current media environment where everyone is forcing you, you know, almost trying to force you to ascribe to one position or the other, but to hold multiple opinions about things. I understand why people are angry. You know, I understand why people would support somebody like Trump. And simultaneously at the same time, I understand why the... So let me back up. I understand why there is a huge rise of right-wing sentiment. I simultaneously see, you know, 10 more years of that could, you know, literally destroy, you know, of right-wing extremism could destroy the entire project of Western civilization.
Yeah, and it will. I don't think it's going to prevail, though. I don't. Mm. I don't. But I agree with everything you're saying. I just don't think it's going to prevail. I think it's going to be a blip on the matrix.
That would be nice.
Yeah.
And I certainly, that would be nice in Europe also, because Europe is becoming increasingly pushed to the right.
Yeah, but here in America, we have an incredible, just the way our system is structured, we're going to see an increased amount of tension over the next, maybe even over the next generation, because I don't think the right is going to win another presidential election for a really, really long time.
So they're falling apart.
Yeah, and that they're falling apart. But they're going to maintain control of the House because of the way gerrymandering and districting works. They're going to make, there's enough podunk districts out there that combined make up the majority of the House. So we're going to see this polarization for a while longer until that's figured out.
Right.
And that's problematic.
Well, I look at all this stuff and I just have to think, everyone's running on, it's like what you said earlier about fundamental technical, like that Obama has is missing certain technical knowledge of things.
Yeah.
I look at things and I just think nobody on the left or the right has any type of a plan that addresses the complexities of the world as it currently exists.
Right.
You know, like we're running on these outdated 19th century ideals about how the world should work that have all been proven not to work. And nobody has caught up with the complexities and realities of the world. You know, the government is not agile like the tech industry is. It's not built to shift quickly. And maybe it shouldn't be, but maybe it should. I mean, maybe we should be considering new political ways of looking at the world that rely on things like new technology and that can change quickly.
I think we should be. We think we should be, and you're right, that there isn't any mainstream plan out there that addresses all of these complexities, which is our immediate challenge, you know, is that we're kind of relegated to this school of incremental growth, you know, and that... as much as I like Bernie Sanders and that he has talked about a lot of interesting topics and that are very controversial topics on a mainstream level, it still is not addressing, you know, these complicated, especially on the technology side, these problems that we're facing on an integration level. So, yeah. What do we do? I don't know, Jason. Keep podcasting.
Thanks. Well, I think I agree with you that I think that...
keep talking about it. That's the best we can do.
Yeah, I mean, that's the cool thing about things like your podcast and about podcasting in general and the internet is the ability to have these conversations and have them quickly and discuss things quickly instead of, you know, spending what would it have been previously, you know, spending a year developing a TV show or something like that. That's then is outdated by the time it gets on
by the
air.
Time. Yeah, absolutely. We have an ability to change the cultural conversation.
Yeah.
Which is great.
And I think that, and one of the reasons why I was so interested in talking about bhakti yoga and things like that is the way that, and I'm sure you found this as well, the way that cultivating a meditation practice or any type of spiritual practice can give you a baseline to get through, you know, give you a baseline to see the world from, to hold true to yourself in the midst of chaos, and also to understand that, to not take it so seriously.
Right.
You know, that all these things, you know, the world can be collapsing and Donald Trump and all this stuff, and you can kind of laugh at it and just kind of let it go by in a way.
Right.
That doesn't mean don't take action, but, you know, it's like, for me, it's like I just look at this and it's kind of like, okay, you know, reality's being entertaining today. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's, my dad used to love that game. He would play that game all the time, especially, you know, oh, reality is super entertaining today. You know,
okay.
Looking at it as sort of like a cosmic joke or something that was kind of lost in some sort of virtual reality bubble, and it's just, you know, humanity's way of just kind of playing its farce upon itself. He always used to say this great thing about George W. Bush, not George W. Bush, Father Herbert Walker Bush, that as far as I know, he's a virtual reality. I've never seen him. I don't know that he exists. I've only ever seen him on the television. I've never met him.
Right.
You know, he's just this creation of electrons.
It's interesting that you refer to that as a game, almost in like a transactional analysis way, as in that's a... What did you mean specifically saying that that's a game? That's interesting to me.
Well, that the game of life is really, if you look at it as if you look at every waking hour and every waking moment of being conscious and alive, and the whole world just kind of in your purview, within your own points of view, within your sight, within your vision, everything is sort of like a chess move. It's what move are you going to play? Well, I'm going to drive over here to Glendale and be on Jason's podcast today, and that's a move I'm going to play. I'm going to go do this, which could earn me a little bit of money to improve my economic game or something. Everything is a move or a choice that you're going to make. And you can make a really shitty choice. And I'm not passing judgment on shitty choices or shitty decisions, but there are good choices and there are presumably less good choices. I don't want to say bad choices, but I've made a lot of shitty choices in my life. And specifically around addictions and things like that. And I've played my game, my set of options, my cards very poorly, you know, at times. And then other times I've played them incredibly well. So if you look at it as a game, which also creates the atmosphere of taking yourself less seriously, of making it a little bit more enjoyable, a little bit more fun,
right,
and a little bit more forgiving.
Right.
You know, that you just get to dance. This is the Leela.
Right. Perfect. Yeah, no, I agree completely. And I think that that's my fundamental outlook on reality. And I think that that's Jnana Yoga for me is seeing through, not seeing through, but understanding that everything is a set of game conditions. You know, essentially everything in existence is somebody playing one, is a set of game conditions between that are agreed on between people. And it's funny because that sounds so minor, but then when you really start to think about it, the whole ball of wax starts to unravel.
Absolutely, and it becomes a lot more fun.
Right.
You know, and you don't have to get bogged down and weighed down by all of these dystopian notions that we're constantly facing and toying with, you know,
right,
because they can be a downer. You can have a lot more fun with it this way.
Right.
And laugh and be more playful.
I always like the James Karst thing about finite and infinite games also.
Oh, you know that one?
No. Yeah, so James Karst was a games theorist who, the book is simply called Finite and Infinite Games. It was written in the 60s, where he basically said there's two types of games. There's games that you play to win, which are finite games, and then games that you play simply to continue play because they're enjoyable, which are infinite games, right? So the best, I think the Hindu traditions are great in positing infinite games above, you know, like bhakti is an infinite game, tantra is an infinite game, simply enjoying your existence at a steady state is an infinite game, you know, whereas things like, you know, the Christian apocalypse, that's a finite game, you know, that there's a set of win conditions on, you know, and I think part of his point also was that, you know, a lot of the damage and wreckage we get in the world is from people trying to play finite games, and that a lot, you know, religions are games. Essentially, religions are big scripted games, and some of them have these incredibly fucked up win conditions, right? Like everyone dies except for us, and is thrown into a pit of torture
fire,
forever.
Right?
You know, we win. That's the win condition. Okay, that's kind of a problem,
right?
As opposed to kind of the Hindu traditions, which by and large are, life is great. You know, you're here as a manifestation of spirit. Enjoy it. It's wonderful. You know, eat another mango. Yeah.
Well, awesome, man. I do have to beat traffic, so I'm going to stop.
Okay. Well, that's a good stopping point.
Is it? Okay. I really enjoyed this, though. Thank you.
Yeah, that was a good one. All right. Well, thank you for coming to the office, too, and thanks for being on the show.
Cool. Thanks, Jason.
All right.